Welcome to the CEN show, a platform where we learn from the world community. And this evening on the panel, we have Professor Amin-Ra, we got Brother Ahi, and I'm expecting more to show up, hopefully. We have Second Take Sports Talk host, Ronnie Roberts, one of our team members who's responsible for our guest this evening. And I just want to say a few things before co-host Ronnie Roberts is going to introduce our guest this evening. I want to say this. The Community Education Network is an organization that advocates education, self, and collective improvement. And we've been in service. I can say that we've been in service for over 5 years now. We started in the summer of 2020 during the pandemic, and December of 2020. We started the CEN show, and then moving forward in 2021, we started Conscious Corner. And then we also have other series of podcasts. And I want to say this. We had a brother named, I call him Iration, because a lot of people don't want to reveal who they are, their personal self. Which I have no issue with that because we want the information to aid the effort of self and collective improvement. So this brother Iration started this organization with me, and he did a great job formulating things with me. And then after that, after we started interviewing people, and then other team members came aboard. And it's just been excellent. Professor Amin-Ra is our master teacher on the platform. He's a professor of 34 years at Long Beach State and a Black Studies professor, and very instrumental in turning a lot of people's lives around, like myself, or enhancing their life. And Brother Mashinda just showed up. He's been with us since day one. Ronnie Roberts been with us since day two. Brother Ahi with us right now has joined us about a year ago and has been around. We have other people that's around that enhances our platform. And I'm very I don't even know what words to use, but I'm very glad that we do what we do, because it's not many platforms like ours, and we truly give our time. We don't give our money, but we give our time, which is the main thing. Our time is more valuable than the money to do what we do. And as long as I can, I'm gonna keep doing this. And hopefully everybody else that's affiliated keep doing the same. We have other people that get us great guests. And it's a real good thing. And I'm very pleased that you all take out your time to help educate the masses with what we think is beneficial. So I'm gonna pass it to Ronnie Roberts, and he's gonna introduce our guests. Ronnie.
Good evening, everyone. Glad to be back on the CEN show with, under the tutelage of Rashiki and Brother Ra. Two men, one I've worked with and two men I've admired for many, many years. We have a special guest tonight that I've known about since, well, when I was a kid growing up in Oklahoma City. His dad was a businessman and influential in the community, a civil rights icon, a business icon, just a man that, as a young kid coming up in Oklahoma City, that you would aspire to be like him because he was had several different interests. Well, at any rate, I became aware of Portwood when I was in junior high school through the band. He went to Central High School, and I went to Douglas High School. And this was back in the day in the early 60s when probably 95% of the blacks in Oklahoma City went to Oklahoma City Douglas. And it was totally integrated communities that we grew up in, totally segregated. Let me rephrase that. But I became more of him mostly through music because he could play the hell out of several different instruments. And I was a budding musician myself. But later on, hadn't seen Portwood probably since high school and ran into him in LAX, of all places. He was returning from his nephew's in LAX, and I was flying my girl to LAX to help me out. I was having a back surgery. Make a long story short, I moved to Oklahoma City 2 years later. We become fast friends, hang out together on a monthly basis. Our ladies are fellow teachers who taught together at Millwood High School, in the Millwood School District in Oklahoma City. They both work together, both Deltas. A lot in common, so he's part of my group. Thunder Crew is what we call ourselves. We all have half-season tickets to the Thunder, so that's one of our passions. But I also, when I went to junior high school, I was in a class with Marlon Looper, and I knew my brother Calvin Looper, who was a couple of years older. And Fort was is about another class ahead of us. So through Mrs. Looper, who was a civil rights icon and started the sit-ins in Oklahoma City, the kids that participated, he was one of the ones chosen, one of the chosen few, because there were many of us who practiced to qualify to go to the sit-ins. And I went to a few of the meetings myself, but didn't pass the test because number one, my mom didn't want me to participate because of my temper, and she said if someone threw something on me, she'd probably have to bury me, which might have been right. But we went through various exercises, as I recall, as a kid at the churches, and it was all under the aegis of the NAACP. Am I correct about that, Fort Wood?
Do you what was the question?
Was Miss Looper was also involved in NAACP, but it was basically her idea to get this together along with your dad and some other leaders in town, but she was at the forefront.
I don't know, probably she had been contemplating it for a while. She was interested. She was a great sort of pupil, really, of Martin Luther King. And he was her basic inspiration.
But at any rate, I went to a couple of practices at the churches, and it just, there was the dedication that it took for them, the courage that it took for them to step out like this. Man, a couple of my classmates were in it. Marilyn Looper was one, and Samuel Craig was another that took part in some early stuff. Stanley Evans was another.
I
These
know it.
all,
I know it.
yeah, he went to OU Bump, we called him back in high school. But these guys, the Miss Looper, her passion, she was a history teacher in Oklahoma City schools, and her passion and her relentless drive to make a change in Oklahoma City was just incredible. I mean, because it was a really dangerous task to be undertaken at this time. And
Sure.
that was the
And
key
you.
reason my mom didn't want me involved, because you say one of those white boys spit on you, you going to jail or you're going to get beat or killed. And she was correct. I didn't have the temperament to go and do that. So Around Oklahoma City, these guys were like heroes to us because they did this. We
So,
didn't realize how monumental it was at the time because we were in the
Ronnie,
middle of it. Yes.
can you mention the lady's name again?
Mrs. Clara Looper, Clara Looper. She
Looper?
was the figurehead.
Okay.
And she was a history teacher and a Langston graduate,
If you want, I'll just take over there. I'm so glad to be here and glad to be talking about Ms.
Fort
Luke.
Wood,
Yes.
I wanted to, first of all, ask you some things before you get to that.
All right.
And Ronnie, I appreciate you giving the story that you did, but well, the title of this podcast, the topic, and then Port Wood Williams is our guest, and the topic is the first successful sit-in in Oklahoma City in 1958. And our first Port Wood, I wanted you to tell us, what exactly is a sit-in, a civil rights sit-in?
All right. In 1958, the sit-ins occurred, but the initiator, the heart, the soul of the sit-ins was none other than Clara Looper. Clara Looper was not only the heart and soul of sit-ins, she was came along at a time when, I'll tell you, she was a woman from a small town called Hoffman in Oklahoma. Hoffman,
But how you doing? Getting in there. All right. How you doing? All right.
Is everybody still
Continue.
tuned in?
Yeah, go
Hoffman.
continue.
Hoffman, they used to say, I had never heard of it until I met Miss Looper. But she, Ronnie has already told you guys about how steadfast she was about anything that was concerned with the upward mobility of Black people. She was from a town so smart and so small that on the if you were driving west, it said you're now entering Hoffman. If you were driving east, on the back of the sign, it said, you are now leaving Hoffman. That's how small Hoffman. Hoffman is a town in eastern Oklahoma. I'd say not too far from the biggest town you would have heard of, Muskogee, maybe Tulsa. Let's just say that it is very, very small. But to get back to why Mrs. Looper had the drive that she had, she graduated from Langston in 1944. She majored in math with a minor in history, believe it or not. That's one thing that most people don't know about Mrs. Looper. She went on to be the first person admitted to the graduate program for history at the University of Oklahoma. She also got her master's from the University of Oklahoma in 1951. But the thing that really motivated her, I found out from her daughter one day when I said, what is it that causes Miss Looper to be so serious, so always wanting to move forward to lift Black people up and so forth. And she told me this story about, I don't know how old Mrs. Looper was, but her younger brother, was sick. I think they were teenagers then. And they took him to the closest hospital to their hometown. But they would not see him because they had some white people that they needed to see. So they didn't see him, and he died. So her motivation started right there. That was what Mrs. Looper was about. I never knew her to have any hobbies. Mrs. Looper did not fish. She did not play cards. She did not do most of the things that most people do because she was so interested in doing what she did. That is just the basis for her existence. I never remember Mrs. Looper doing. I talked to her daughter the other day, and she said she never. There's a picture of Mrs. Looper. Okay. Rigo, I don't know whether you want me to go on telling your story or whether you want some room for somebody else to comment.
Well, I want you to define what a sit-in is so we can
Okay.
have clarity on what a sit-in is.
In 1960, four guys walked into a eating establishment in Greensboro, North
North
Carolina,
Carolina.
and sit down at the counter and demanded to be and asked to be served. And these are the people who eventually would be called the first sit-in. And we had to go back and sort of prove that in 1958, the sit-ins were started here. Well, in the first place, a week before our sit-in started, they had a sit-in in Wichita, Kansas, but it only lasted for a day. So it really, when I say that the sit-ins here were the original sit-ins, we had the most successful, the first successful sit-ins that anybody knew of. It is a long story, the story of how it got to be a sit-in that had to do with some kids. Mrs. Looper wrote a play in 1957 called Brother President. And Brother President was actually a story about Martin Luther King. I made some notes here so I didn't leave, so I won't leave anything out. Brother President was not only about Martin Luther King, it was about his nonviolent techniques that he used to eliminate all the segregation in Montgomery, Alabama. After Mrs. Looper wrote this play, the play was seen by a guy by the name of Herbert Wright, who was the National Youth Director of the NAACP at that particular time. He was so impressed with the play that he invited Clara and the main cast of the play to New York City. They presented a play as a salute to what was called young freedom fighters at the time. The trip to New York, when they made the trip to New York to present the play, they took along a lot of people who weren't even members of the NAACP because at that time, most teenage black youth in Oklahoma had never been out of the state of Oklahoma. So Mrs. Looper thought it would be a good idea for them to see a part of the another part of the world. When they went to do the play in New York, they took the bus and they took what they called the Northern Route to New York. And they were able to sit down and eat at different places along the way. And this was a feeling that they had never had being from Oklahoma. On the way back, they took what they called the Southern Route, which made them stop, let's say, in Washington, D.C., and some other southern places, that they were not able to eat at the restaurants and so forth. This is what started Mrs. Looper to think about changing things in Oklahoma. That's when she decided that that's what we would do. And that was the spark of what was called the sit-ins. A few months after we got back from the trip is when the sit-in started, where we walked into Catch Drugstore, which was actually a chain of drugstores, although we didn't know that. We just knew the drugstore in our city. We were sitting at a meeting. Usually the meetings for the youth council were held on a Monday evening, once a month. And we had no discussions after we got back from the trip. By the way, I didn't make the trip. I haven't figured out yet how it was that I didn't make the trip to New York, but I didn't. But on the evening that we decided that we would go down, it was done so much on the spur of the moment. We were just sitting there at the meeting and said, "Oh, we're going to do it." And so Mrs. Looper said, "Well, we've been talking about it for a long time." And somebody else said, "Yeah, when are we going to do it?" And it was just said, "Well, let's just do it this evening. We're going to go down to Catch Drugstore and sit in. We'll sit at the bar stools, which probably ran about 20, 30 feet. It was a long bar stool, long counter. 13 people were at the meeting that night. We became known as the original 13. There were nine girls and four boys. We walked in to sit in at Catch that fateful day, and everybody ordered a Coke. That was the moment, actually, that the sit-ins began.
Okay, I want to show you something. Can you tell me if this is you are?
Right. Okay.
Is that it?
That's a part of it. I can name almost all this. This is Pat McGlory. I can name the people on there. Paul Anderson, I remember him. But this was after the sit-ins had been. This was
This is
probably
1960, huh?
right. The sit-in started in
Okay.
58.
Yeah, that
Yeah.
wouldn't be you guys, but you knew the people.
Oh yeah,
Okay.
I know all of those people. Yeah,
Okay.
but I can, you can just ask. I can tell you a lot about, what happened, if that's what
Okay,
you need.
so we before that, before I go to the panel, because I'm going to go to the panel. I want to show these pictures that you sent me, and I want you to tell us about them.
Okay.
Okay, let me get to it. Here's, let me see. Here's one right here. Here. Okay. You see it?
Yes, that's a picture of me standing next to a statue of me.
Okay, that's a statue of you, and you were how old then?
15.
He was 15.
Right.
Okay, what was this event here? Was it an
No,
event?
this is something that people did who did recognize is they recognized the fact that we had been overlooked as far as the sit-in movement was concerned, because there were no publications out that showed us as being the ones who actually started the sit-ins of the civil rights movement in 1958. The earliest sit-ins that they knew of were the ones in Greensboro in 1960. Now, this is what you have to understand about the sit-ins that we have. The way the government, the mayor, and everybody in Oklahoma City chose to deal with us walking in the cats and sitting in, is they chose to low play it. It was not covered by the newspaper. It was not covered by the television stations. So therefore, there was no violence. So the news people somehow failed to say anything about it. And so that was the beginning of the fact that we were never recognized. And they capitulated in 2 or 3 days and decided that they would serve us. And not only did they decide to serve us, Katz, I found out later, was a chain drugstore even in those days, just like CVS today. And so not only did he decide, the owner of Katz decide to serve us, in every other store that they had another at least 20 or 30 stores all over. They had Katz drug stores in Kansas City, in Colorado, all over the country, really. And he opened all of them up that 3 day after 3 days of us sitting in at his drugstore. And what happened is I don't know, these are some other people that decided that they would honor us by building statues of the people who participated. They were going to do the whole counter, but that would have made a counter so big until they wouldn't have been able to move it. When you bronze the counter, what they did is took a section of the counter. You might have another, if you can find another picture of it. These were us just standing behind the counter. They did it like that because they wouldn't have been able to handle the whole counter. It was so long. There were probably room for 20 or 30 people at that counter. So what they did is they decided to honor us by making these statues, statues of the individuals. All 13 individuals are shown in one manner, either sitting at the counter or standing behind the counter. So you're just seeing my particular status. This is a picture of me and my son
Oh, okay.
standing with my statue.
Tony Williams.
Yeah. This was on the day of
Okay.
the dedication in February. This was like a 6 or 7 year project. From the time they
This.
started and said they were going to do this, and it's the counter is now shown outside, but on the very spot that Katz drugstore has been torn down since then, years ago. But this is done at Main and Robinson in Oklahoma City.
So you took these pictures in February of this year?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Excellent.
Yes, this
So
is.
there's more pictures,
Oh
but
yeah.
I want to get to the panel and the questions.
All right.
I'm gonna start off with Professor Ra. You have to unmute.
Yeah, again, I want to thank Brother William for coming on and Port William and Brother Ronnie. This is monumentous for a number of reasons. See, they had segregation laws. And in Oklahoma, you couldn't sit in the restaurant. And that's where the concept of sit-in came. They broke the laws when they went and sit-in. And they wanted to break the discrimination laws or what they called race laws, or they called, discrimination laws that were all over the South and all over the country in many ways, either through jurisprudence or de facto. De facto mean they just practice it. Jurisprudence mean they went to court or congregation or Congress and passed laws that separated. And it didn't just have a civil, you couldn't eat there. You couldn't drink from a water fountain where white folks drank. This is when Port was living down there. And you couldn't do a lot of things where white people was. You understand? So you couldn't go to the restaurant.
then you couldn't go to certain stores. And if you did, sometimes you had to go in the back door or wait till they bring the stuff out to you.
Right.
You know, but that was good. This is Black Women's Month. I'm aware it's International Women's Month, but we have a Black woman focus. And the Sister Clara Luper should be one of the main people recognized from a historical standpoint.
Real talk.
This sister was monumentous and relentless. You understand? As far as, and brave. I mean, for them to go in and sit in that cat's drugstore, they could have been shot, killed, and lynched in them days. You understand? But once they did it, it had a domino effect, according to history.
Right.
They began to desegregate not only cats, but other parts of Oklahoma in that area.
Right.
You know, the city council passed a law, the desegregation law. So this was very much in 1958. We're talking 1958. See, that was before the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. So they set the tone. And when she took the kids to New York to see the play, it was, you know, and then came back, you know, I mean, to expose them. And I like what Brother Port said. They went down the north and came back south so the kids can get an experience and see what was going on.
Right.
This, see, we sometimes forget. We focus on Garvey, we focus on Malcolm, we focus on Medgar, but we focus on a lot of the men, Reverend Shadowford, and all of them. But there were some sisters that was even tough.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, they were tough.
Right. And well, you know, Bob, but that's what I was going to say. Clara Luper was a modern-day version of a cross between Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. Winnie Mandela. And yeah.
No doubt.
And she's very brave. And they recognize her by creating a plaza in her name out there in Oklahoma. They got a plaza. You know, Clara Luper Plaza.
Yeah, that was the plaza right there where that picture was taken.
Yeah, you know, named after her.
Right.
And the and you know, the people in Oklahoma know it.
Yes.
But this is why it's important to Black studies and for us to get this history, because it brings out unsung heroes and heroines.
Right.
That we didn't know nothing about. You know, so it's just like they give Rosa Parks is the one that set in. It was this other sister, also Candace something. Sanders or something. She was one of the first to sit in. I mean, to not give up her seat for the bus.
Right.
But I mean, now the one in Greensboro, they were met with violence.
Yes.
You know, John Lewis, them, they were beat. They beat the hell out of them.
Yeah.
You understand, for coming in there, and not counting other things they did as far as that was concerned. But what they did in Oklahoma led to voter registration, desegregation of schools, desegregation throughout Oklahoma.
All the world.
You understand? And the reason they don't teach it or expose this historical dynamic, they don't want our kids to be motivated to do some of these things today, to participate in protest. So they don't highlight it in the main media. And we don't have the main media to reach our kids individually. I mean, you know, they watch the Academy Award and these white folks giving white folks awards saying this is the best picture. And then they give a Black person an award. But it's not like, well, the NAACP Image Award. It's not on that statue. But the point is that this was a part of our struggle. And this sister needs to be recognized and honored even more and mentioned more. This is important to Black studies, because research would have brought this out. See? And that's why when I'm in my class, I would tell them, I want you to go research something. I want you to write about it. I want you to get all the data about it, the personality, the event, the individual, and do a biography of the individuals and do an analysis of the data and the information that they experienced. Because, I didn't want the students just talking about, well, they did this, they did that. No, no. We want to know how they thought, how she thought, and that's what Port was saying. He was telling you the mentality the sister had, the way she was thinking. In 1958, Black woman thinking like that, most women in them days were at home, man, washing clothes, cleaning up, picking cotton. They were the backbone. They put boards in a lot of their husbands back, because they broke Black men in them days. You couldn't even defend your family in certain situations.
Oh, no.
You get lynched.
Sure.
But
you know,
the Black woman stuck with them anyway and became wives to these men that this white man broke.
Right.
You understand?
But what the young kids don't, they don't really understand what it was like back then. Black people had a certain day that they could go to the zoo. That day was Thursday. I'm just trying to give you an idea of how times were. You could try on clothes at the clothing stores. I mean, you could buy clothes there, but you couldn't try them on. Some shoe companies, you had to go to the back door to not get free shoes, but buy shoes. There were so many things happening, negative things, as far as Blacks were concerned in those days, until it really wasn't, you didn't really have to be that brave. And we probably were too young to know what the dangers were anyway. We just sort of understood that we were born into a world that was hostile, and there were some wrongs that we needed to right. And so that's what I'd normally say when somebody asked me, were you guys afraid? No, we weren't afraid. We wanted to be free. And I don't think anybody is afraid under those conditions.
That's powerful.
So I never thought about being afraid. That was nothing. I mean, the genius of the sit-ins, Regal wanted to know, actually, the genius of it was the fact that we chose to use kids. So we walked in, there were 13 people. We could not have been less intimidating, because there were 9 girls and boys, and all the boys were not big boys. We were all small guys. So people sort of felt sorry for us. That was the genius of it. Our youngest member, who is now deceased, was only 7 years old. She wasn't a member of the youth council, but her mother was one of the drivers of the car, and she couldn't leave her daughter at home by herself. So she said, well, I'll go sit in too, because she was along with her mother. She was the youngest. Lana Pogue was her name. She was the by far the youngest sitter. I think she was about 7. And the oldest was like maybe 17, because a couple of people who sat in with us sat in for 2 days and then they were off to go to college. So I think it was Alma Posey was one of the older girls, and a girl named Betty Germany. But while I'm talking, one of the interesting things about the sit-iners, though, and I don't know how significant this is, but every one of the original 13 went on to get at least a undergraduate college degree, every one of us. There are still 10 of us alive. we lost one of the original 13 in last part of January, Aretha Carroll Tolliver. But yeah, it's a miracle that there are still 10 of us that are still alive. That's been almost 68 years ago. If you count back, yeah.
Because I guess I was 12.
That's phenomenal. And like you said, a lot of bravery. So I'm going to come back to Professor Rock. Ernest, do you have a question or a comment?
I think his mic is muted.
He got to unmute.
I was talking to a little lady. I had a little episode with my wife. But yeah, I love to hear stories like this because, you know, like he said, my dad had me out of 7 years old, and we marked our first picket lines and protest lines in 1945 here in Long Beach. You know, and this was at the time, this was a Ku Klux Klan stronghold, but somehow or another, I guess we just fortunate that we didn't face no violence. The only thing, we got a lot of phone calls and threats, and because he'd be a secret NAACP meeting, and they'd call and harass us and say we forgot the address of the meeting and we need to know where it was. But my mom was hip to that. She said, "Well, I don't know because he doesn't tell me," you know.
Right, right.
So we were just kind of fortunate. And then I think my dad, he used to take my sister and I on all his protest marches. We protest markets and lunch counters and stuff like you guys do. And then he'd always told me, said, "Son, when you grow up, your kids might be facing the same thing." Say, "Cause that white man, he's something to deal with, you know." And then I see it's happening. I see stories like this, and you go to probably any town in America, and you know, if you dig up that history and find out that this has been happening all along, you know, and it's just a never give up fight. We gotta keep the fight. So,
right. So thanks, Ernest. Brother Ahi.
Yes, brother. Sister Clara Luper, civil rights icon and freedom fighter, like you said, she was, you kind of compared her to Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. And she fought her whole life. It kind of looks like she not only dealt with trying to open the counters at the drugstores and eating counters, but apparently she was having to do with anything that was in the public, that the public was supposed to have access to, she was in on it. So her whole life was about civil rights. From what I see here, and even to the point, I have a couple questions I wanted to ask you.
Fire away.
In 72, she tried her bid as senator?
Yeah, she ran for the Senate.
And that's my first question is, why? Okay, on that. Right. And the next question I have for you is, your view, your view on being immortalized with the, you know, as a 15-year-old having your statue there for, golly, I guess it's going to be for hundreds of years for people to see, and it's going to spark some type of conversation. And then there was a third question I had for you. I'm trying to think, my mind is so scattered. But
maybe
it'll come back to me.
One, You want him to ask that one, answer that one question you just
Yeah,
asked?
to answer those two questions, and I have another question. I'm trying to think of it now. Okay.
Yeah,
The
but he can
one
answer
question
one.
about the one question about why did she run for senator in
You
your estimate, and the other one about the being immortalized like that, your whole view on that whole process to
Right.
to be an
Well,
immortal.
yeah. Well, the first one, I don't know. As far as her running for the Senate, I don't know, but I have my ideas that somebody put her up, thought she would be a good candidate, maybe somebody put her up to it, because she wasn't really a political person, believe it or not. But she wrote a book in 1979 called Behold the Wall. And it talked about all the walls that Black people in her lifetime had to hurdle or get around or get through, basically. It was a book that was autobiographical. So if you can find that book in the library, Behold, a lot of people get it wrong and say Beyond the Walls, but it's called Behold the Walls. And it pretty much t I'm pretty much would probably tell you why she ran for the Senate. I don't know. And as far as it just so happened that you're talking about being immortalized, that a kid, Mrs. Looper, I knew her away from. She went to my church. If you look at the 13 sit-inners, five of them went to the same, to the Fifth Street Baptist Church. Because Mrs. Luther had her two children, Calvin and Marilyn, went to our church. And then Alma and Barbara Posey also went to Fifth Street Baptist Church. And I'm trying to see, there was another member of the original 13. Then two of them of the original 13 were relatives of Ms. Looper. Richard Brown and Betty Germany were, nieces or nephews or whatever. So, and plus, Mrs. Looper's house where we held the NAACP meetings was a block away from my house. So, it was a short run for me to get. She lived in the middle of the 1800 block of Park Place, and I lived in the 1700 block of Park Place. And what I'm just saying is that it was more than likely what I me winding up being a member was all because of Mrs. Looper's urging. She saw me every Sunday, and she would say, "When are you coming?" She finally got me to join it. And once I joined it and saw what the youth council was doing and what it was about, I liked it. But I'm just saying it was just a serendipitous thing that happened to me. It could have happened to anybody. I just was in the right place at the right time. And so I will, that's the way I feel about it. But I'm happy that I was there. My dad drove the first car. When we decided to go down and sit in, you see, it was so spur of the moment. We didn't know. We said, okay, we're going to do it now. How are we going to get there? That was how spur of the moment the sit-ins were. And so my dad, they knew, you got to remember that everybody didn't even have a car in those days. You had to find some cars to drive all of us down there. And my dad was the first car. And Ms. Poe, who brought her little daughter along with her, was the
Oh,
second car.
which brings me to my next question for you
Okay.
is, apparently you weren't expecting any violence because you had the children. You brought the 7-year-old, and then you guys were so young.
Right.
What did they prepare you for?
Oh, I don't know. But the idea was we the idea was to have the children there, that would eliminate the violence. That's why I say that was the genius of the whole sit-in movement. As soon as like the guys you were talking about in Greensboro, those were grown people, those were college students.
College kids, yeah.
And so, it was all right for them to. They did things to us. I mean, they pushed us sometimes. A couple of people got spit on. But nobody ever did anything. I mean, like I said before, we were so unintimidating until people actually, I think, sort of felt sorry for us, really. And I have to admit that actually, whoever was the chief of police in those days really did a good job. They didn't act like they were on our side, but on the other hand, they didn't act like they were against us either. So that.
So you, I'm asking, what did you expect to happen?
We had no expectations because, you
We were
know,
kids.
yeah, we were kids, number one.
Or
And
the leaders, perhaps. The leaders didn't expect, what did the leaders expect?
well, you probably have to talk to the leaders to find, I mean, they didn't discuss it with us. That was the situation. Actually, there were only two grown-ups other than the people that drove us down there, and that was Mrs. Looper and then our lawyer, who was E. Melvin Porter. They were the only grown-ups. There was some pushback on us having the sit-ins without letting other community leaders know about it. But our feelings were that if they were interested in, we didn't think that it would work if we used grown-ups. Like I said, the whole idea of using kids was because, and it worked out. Because if they had attacked us, they would have been seen. That would have been reported. That would have been on the news, we thought. But if that had happened, so what?
Well, so the news was somehow in cahoots with everybody else because it wasn't reporting. That was big news. That was big news. So it wasn't a free press, and it wasn't an objective type of press you had there.
Well, it wasn't a free press, and it was a free press, but not in the sense that you're talking about. Because that was a good strategy on their part, they thought. But see, what happened was they thought that they would acquiesce, and we'd be satisfied. So they decided that, well, go on and serve them. They didn't know that as soon as they served us, that gave us a taste of victory, and it was on from then. On because the sit-ins lasted for 6 years. The sit-in, as the professor was saying, lasted until 1964, when they passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson, when we started the sit-ins, Dwight Eisenhower was the president, and when the sit-ins were over, Lyndon Johnson was president, as you know.
All right. Excellent. Thank you. He Brother Mashinda. Brother Mashinda.
Yo, there I am. Yeah, I'm fumbling with my phone. But look, yeah, and very interesting. All I can say is, Oklahoma was doing their part, and I appreciate the brother coming on, but to even to keep this history alive, it's very important, especially our young people, to be able to hear this. We hear about, like you mentioned earlier, we hear Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and different people that were instrumental in this, in the movement of for different things that was going down during the 60s and fifties and throughout our life, but at the same time, I really appreciate hearing this story. I was very unaware. We don't know everything, and to just to pl give up, that plug for Miss Clara Looper, who's like I said, she's an icon, and everybody that was associated with her, she stuck her put her life on the line to be part of the movement, educate others, and to make people understand the importance of what was going on. So, again, my hat's off to, Oklahoma, being part of the movement. I remember as a young kid in the 70s, 60s, 60s, being part of all kind of boycotts at a very young age, and doing things, didn't understand, probably just had to do it because, my dad said, "Hey, this is what we doing." And then later on, as I got a little older, I started understanding it, so anybody that was, for the freedom, and then there's questions, like, I had a grandmother. She died, I think, in 2013. She was 1 month short of 99, and she integrated the park. I'm here in Louisiana, and they integrate in a little town here with Deacons of the Fence right here, got relatives that was a part of that, so it's all connected. We're not gonna say, "Oh, the deacons is better than the ones in Oklahoma." No, everybody, there's
Everybody.
different. Yeah, everybody, 10 toes down.
Right.
At that time. So
Right.
beautiful, beautiful story. I like to do more research on it and share it with the people that I come in contact with. It's very important to share this synergy, this of information that that's trying to, they're trying to bury it. They're trying to bury it. But when we got brothers like the brother that's on now that's coming on saying, "Hey, y'all check this out. Did y'all know this?" It's like, wow, So it's not only inspirational, but it's imperative that we know this. We need to know as many stories, as many historical references as possible to make sense of why we're trying to, maintain our position in this world. That, hey, we don't have to, So anyway, it's a critical, very, not only a critical analysis, but it's very imperative that this story gets out. We've heard of the Sojourner Truths and the, all the different figures, but here's Oklahoma. Here's you go back in time, and you guys, Brother Ronnie, brother, all anybody. Well, I'm just saying, anybody that was in Oklahoma, maybe growing up, that knew about this story. That's why you are who you are, because you had people like Miss Claire Looper saying, "Hey, we got to stand for something," and it's my hats off, and I'm gonna leave it at that. That I appreciate you coming on tonight. Powerful story, and I will pass it on. How about that?
Good. Good.
Thanks a lot, Brother Mashinda. Ronnie, did you have a question for Portwood?
Well, I'm refreshing my memory. During this time, it's very vivid in my imagination because I would go down to downtown Oklahoma City on Saturdays with my mom and my aunt, and I would pack packages that they would buy in the stores. These white folks would let us spend our money in the stores, and Cat's Drugstore was one that always stood out to me because you could smell the hamburgers and the cedar milkshakes, and I love milkshakes and hamburgers. Plus, Cat's Drugstore was one of the few places, one of the only places that we could use the bathroom in downtown Oklahoma City. And they had a colored and a white drinking fountain backed by this very nasty bathroom that was so bad that you try to pretty much hold it. And the water fountain looked like crap. It just brings back memories to me. We had all these restaurants that I used to dream about, even though in downtown Oklahoma City, one of them being Kip's the Big Boy, could smell the pancakes coming out of there. And we could go down in the shop just like normal people, mixing with the white folks. They weren't bothering us. We weren't bothering them, but we could not eat. We could not go in any restaurant in Oklahoma City, period, that wasn't on the east side, the northeast side of Oklahoma City. It just wasn't happening. We couldn't go in. We had barbecue joints, hot dog places, but they were all black. But another key point, guys, during this time, we had black doctors, black dentists, black everything, because we had to. We actually, as a people, and I say this to this day, and many scholars have said this, Segregation. We lost when integration came.
Yeah.
Douglas High School was one of the finest schools in Oklahoma City.
Right.
It was on par with any school in Oklahoma City. And we had
Well,
a great faculty. 90% of them were Langston graduates because it's the only college we could go to.
right.
When Miss Looper got her master's at OU, she wasn't sitting inside any classrooms, mind you. She was sitting outside the door. My professor at Lexington, business law professor, Ada Laura Scipio Fisher,
yes.
First black woman to get a law degree from the University of Oklahoma. She taught me business law at Lexington for 2 semesters. She sat outside the classroom, outside the door, could
Right.
not sit in the classrooms. This is what folks were experiencing when they got masters.
Right.
And at the time, Langston didn't offer masters. Not many HBCUs did back in the 50s and 60s. Couldn't get
Right.
a master's. Still
Right.
can't get them at some HBCUs. So it was a completely different environment, but we as kids, we just came to accept the fact that we had two different societies going on in Oklahoma City. We couldn't go in the Capitol Hill area at night. Edmond, which is a prominent city in Oklahoma City, right next, I'm 4 miles from Edmond. That's a sundown town. We had sundown towns surrounding us all over Oklahoma City. You guys know what a sundown town is?
I do.
Do you
guys
know
what a sundown
town is? Explain it.
That's like
explain
a
what a sundown town is.
Well, if you're a black person and you get caught in these places after 6 o'clock, you might get strung up or whooped all the way back to the east side.
Right.
We ventured out in Capitol Hill when I was in the 10th grade with some guys who had some driver's licenses, and we shouldn't have done that. Well, I mean, they whooped our ass all the way back to the east side of Oklahoma City.
You know, they had a sign that said, "Nigga, don't let the sun catch you."
Don't let it catch you.
In other words, get out of Capitol Hill before the sun goes down.
It just wasn't for us. It was for our dads. And, you know, our dads do better. They would warn us, boy, don't go out there. When we finally start driving, don't get your ass on that Capitol Hill.
They have any, like, two separate towns, like, for blacks and whites? Like, Little Rock had a black
right.
section and a white section.
Yeah, we were in northeast part of town. We were
right.
bounded. We could go as far as 36th Street. We even had a few blacks live out.
Well, you could be over there at night, couldn't you? In the black
Yeah,
park?
But it was on the northeast side. Out where I live now was the woods. But anywhere out here in northwest Oklahoma City,
right.
No, you wouldn't be out here. If you were out here at night, you had on a maid uniform.
Right.
Or you were cutting yards and you were doing some kind of shit and the police were used to seeing you. Because if you're out here walking on the streets, well, you're going to jail, they're going to get beat up. One of them. But it didn't, you know, as kids, did this bother Portwood and I? No, because we were trapped on the east side.
Right.
Well, it wasn't nothing but black folk.
Was Tulsa, Oklahoma near you guys?
100 miles away.
100 miles northeast.
31
yeah.
years. 100 miles north. Same stuff going on there.
Right.
I'm going to tell you how crazy this was. The race riot in Tulsa, I didn't find out about that until I was in college. I went to an all-black high school, Oklahoma City Douglas, one of the better black high schools in the country. And nobody, and they had black history, nobody ever said anything about the Tulsa race riot.
Because I just heard about a buddy of mine I met in 55, and he was from there, and he kept talking about it, and I saw we hadn't heard anything. You know, the rest of the guys thought he was just
yeah.
kind of joking, you know.
How could I not know that? We had to take Oklahoma history in high school, learn all about the white folks' laws and stuff.
Right.
We took American history all through high school. We talked about slavery for maybe 2 hours. And they moved on. And you gotta understand, we had all black faculty. When I graduated from Oklahoma City Douglas in 1964, we had 2,000 kids there and one half white boy whose daddy was black and his mom was white, and we called him white boy. His name was Dwight.
One
but
half.
It was complete segregation. Complete.
Right.
Well, no black folks living where white folks were living.
Yeah. Well, you know, one as a side note though, one thing Miss Lupa said, another thing that inspired her was when she was a child in Hoffman, they had their books that they had, they would get the books, the old books from the white school.
Pass them down,
And they'd been, and in many cases, they would start to read something in their books and get to a certain point, and the rest of the pages had been torn out. So they never got the whole story. But when we set in, it took us 3 years to get John A. Brown's, which was a department store, to capitulate. And during that time, Miss Lupa spent a lot of time talking with Mrs. John A. Brown and her lawyer. And believe it or not, they became friends. And I heard that story a long time. I didn't believe it until I talked to Mrs. Looper's daughter about it. She said, "Oh yeah, they went to lunch, and even after old man John A. Brown died, they still would once in a while go to lunch together." So that was one positive thing that came out of it.
This is excellent, Professor Ra.
Just appreciate what everybody said, if I understand correctly. That's what I wanted to emphasize. Not only did Ronnie not get that education about Tulsa from school, black people wouldn't even talk about it because they didn't want people to get hurt. And that's what we have to start doing. A lot of these youth don't know the struggle that got them to where they are today, and the hardship. Parents just told me I had to walk 2 miles to school uphill and down. And it was a school right across the street, but it was for white kids, and all. These youth think that the life they're living today was always like this. They don't have that sense of humility and appreciation, and they don't feel an obligation to make it better for the next generation. See, each generation prior to these 80s and 90s had a mission. And they felt that they wanted to get in position to help others, and they wanted to try to get rid of some of the racial impediments or systems that kept them from getting places. But we have a generation today that they be saying things like, "I haven't experienced no racism." You understand? Why can't we all get along? And it's a different, and that's because we don't talk to them and sit down in our homes and show them these pictures and let them see, and then tell them what their mission is. To help others to speak truth, do justice, and walk in the way of right. That's all I wanted to say, Rusty.
Let me ask you a question, Ernest and Raw. When my good friend Mel Collins moved to Long Beach from Tulare in the mid-70s, he and Nida could had really a tough time finding a place to live. They went to several different places in Long Beach and were turned down. They would all tell Nida that you're fine, but your husband is too dark. Now, Mel is not a really dark guy. You guys know Mel, right?
There's the red line in here and
Right,
long see.
right. But they would tell Nida she was fine, but Mel, your husband is too dark. And this was in the
It was
mid-70s. So they it ended up being able to buy a place right over by Kaiser, right off Pacific Coast Highway, right before you get to the traffic circle. So that's where they were first able to move. But they went to several other places in Long Beach, and this was in the mid-70s. So My question to Ernest and Brother Rye is, could you guys eat everywhere in California? Could you guys go anywhere and eat?
No. You know, because they had a war. We were talking about integrating stores. They had a Woolworth store down on Pine. You could only eat. They had an Al drugstore on Long Beach Boulevard and 3rd Street. Because my grandfather worked there as a janitor. You could go in there and eat, but you could get a sandwich. Now, in Woolworth, you could come and buy a sandwich, but you couldn't eat at that counter. Couldn't sit at the counter. They wouldn't serve. So that was the first discrimination we ran into in the 50s when I was a kid. You know, a lot of us kids, we'd go down there, we'd stand around and try to make them serve us, but the waitress would just get up and leave. And so they wouldn't serve you. And then my dad, he broke that up, but he first started on the schools because they had a, used to give black minstrel shows in the schools to raise money for the school PT, and he hated that with a passion. I never seen him get mad at anything but that. But there were, you know, and there were most stores you couldn't eat. There would be little private restaurants. You go in there and they wouldn't serve you. You know, this was kind of like in the late 40s, right, early 50s.
Right. You know,
Rico.
When I was coming up, we just stayed in the black community.
Yeah.
The only time we saw white people was on TV.
Yep.
Unless they were the police or fire department.
Right.
The mailman. And then, so we never really interacted with white folks in Watts, Compton, well, in Watts, in South Central. Because black people had hamburger stands, shoe shine parlors, barbershop.
Yeah.
You know, even little convenience stores, you know, and it was a different era during that little period. I would like to say from maybe 1963 all the way up to about 1970. And then as far as housing segregation, they would send a black person to go try to rent the house, they say they don't have no openings, even though they had a sign up there. Then they'd send a white person and they'd say, oh yeah, we got a vacancy. That's what led to the fair housing movement in Long Beach. But they had to set them up. See, civil rights law, and as I conclude, you had to prove discrimination and civil rights. You had to show a long history of discrimination. You could, you know, they call it prejudice. People had a right to be prejudiced, but they can't build an institutional behavior that inhibits people or affect their lives with life-giving, life-saving goods and services and a fair justice system. They were still killing black people, the police. They were still harassing black people in Long Beach and Compton and Watts and things of this nature. But we just stayed in the hood. You know, we went to school there. We grew up there.
Movie theaters there.
Yeah. Now black people spread out.
Yeah.
You know,
Rigo, this picture that you're showing now.
Yeah, that's really something. Looks just like
this guy to the left. This is Mrs. Lupus. This is Calvin.
Calvin Lupus.
Mrs. Lupus' son.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Okay. And the lady back in the back, you see, with the gray hair, was our spokesperson of the original 13. Her name is Barbara Posey. She's standing next to her statue. And now her, does anybody know the sports reporter on ESPN, Bomani Jones?
I certainly do.
Okay, now he is her, this is his wife.
What?
This is not his wife. This is his mother.
This is his mother, yes.
This is his mother.
Bomani Jones' mom, yes.
Bomani Jones' mother.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And he's a very highly educated man himself.
Right. Well, yeah, his father's a PhD. I mean, his father's a PhD.
Yeah, he has master's degrees. He's a smart guy.
Right. Yeah. But Barbara, an interesting thing, though, is Barbara and I were born the same month, the same year. Mm-hmm. June the 23rd. We have exactly the same birthday.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Is 13 statues there?
Yes. Some of them are sitting, you know, are standing, and some of them are actually sitting at the counter.
Oh, okay. And where is this? Like that, downtown Oklahoma?
Yes. This is where
right smack in the heart of downtown Oklahoma City.
Yeah, right
in the middle. Is that Oklahoma City?
Oklahoma City, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, Portwood.
Yes.
I have a case scenario for you.
All right.
Case scenario question.
Okay.
You're invited to a high school to speak to high school students. Mm-hmm. Briefly, what would you tell them about the sit-in in 1958?
Well, I'd start with the description of how things were then. Because if you don't establish that, I mean, it would be unimaginable that Black people had to go at a certain day to go to the zoo.
If we couldn't comprehend it.
Right. There's no way that they could comprehend that. You know. And there were a lot of places, the professor was saying, that you could spend your money there, but you couldn't sit down and eat. You had to get a to go. If we had time, I would tell you a story about when I was about a year before the sit-in started, an incident that happened with me out near Oklahoma City University, where a person went in there to get food, and that's how they found out that they couldn't eat it there. So they brought it back to Oklahoma City University, where we were having a band convention, and told us that where they got the food, and you could buy it there, but you couldn't eat it there. To make a long story short, we decided to go down there. We ordered. Now, this was, you remember, Ronnie, you probably remember Ira Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Ira Hall was a pretty bright guy. In fact, he was the first genius I ever knew.
Brilliant guy. He was on the Federal Reserve Board.
Right.
Board of Governors.
Yeah, he was the first Black person from Oklahoma to get a full scholarship to Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when they integrated the schools in Oklahoma Northeast, he and Dr. Atkins' son, you remember, were the people.
Edwin Atkins.
Was that his first name?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't remember. He was Dr. Yeah.
Edwin.
Yeah, right. He went to they went to Northeast. I'm trying to remember. Let's see. But anyway, he and I decided that what we would do is we would go down to that store where the people bought the, we couldn't wait. And he was only an eighth grader at the time. I was a ninth grader. We went to the store where they bought the food, but they couldn't eat it there. And we took about four or five other band members with us. And we ordered as much food as we could order. And when the young man got the food prepared, he said, okay, that'll be whatever it was. In those days, believe it or not, it was probably only about $30. And we decided, no, we want to eat it here. And he said, well, you can't eat it here. I said, well, we don't want it then. And we walked out. And the last thing we heard him say was, you can't do that. we haven't seen him since then. But this happened about a year before the sit-ins. So I was prepared.
That was stick and move. Walk out.
Right. Well, that was, what were they going to do?
Well, they could have chased you.
Oh, no. No.
So you guys wasn't having that, huh?
Oh, no. Who is my? We couldn't keep from laughing. That was the whole thing. Is you know, we were dead serious. But I, you know.
Well, you guys definitely sound brave to me because, yeah,
But
to,
as
yeah.
Rod said,
Had no
we were
better
on the
sound
east side
given.
90% of the time, 95% of the time, we were on the east side, dude. You just didn't go anywhere else. We were locked in, literally.
Right.
And you really didn't want to go anywhere else because everything you needed was in the black community, not like it is now. Everything we needed was in our community.
Right.
Doctors, lawyers, dentists, carpenters, every electricians. We were a self-contained community. My family doctor, I stayed on 16. My family doctor, Dr. Barker, was on 19. This was back when doctors made house calls. When we got measles, mumps, and all that crap, Dr. Barker would come to the house, give you a shot in your ass, and go ahead on, and you well.
Yeah.
The next day,
Right.
that's how it worked. I mean, we were a self-contained, beautiful community. Led by guys, you know, I was telling a guy the other day, I never saw my dad in a pair of jeans in his life. My dad would cut the yard in khakis and Stacy's.
Oh, yeah.
Mean, these guys are so sharp and so clean. The role models that we had, our coaches and our teachers, they were just extraordinary guys who lived through some of the most oppressive racism areas. The things that Port's dad and my dad had to endure,
I don't see how they did
I don't know how they did it. Now, my dad used to tell me all the time, "Listen, boy, always carry cash money in your pocket. Don't try to go to the window around these white folk with no check. Don't look them directly in the eye too long. Make eye contact with them. Say yes, sir, and no, sir." I'm like, "Man, I don't like these people. Why I gotta say yes, sir, and no, sir to keep them getting your ass whooped?"
That's what my mother told me before I went in the army.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah,
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
Well, you know what? Portwood, I'll take my hat off to you. It's a real rich history that you have. And you know, we benefit from hearing about this history because I didn't know nothing about it until I met you.
Really?
You know, and I didn't heard the, you know, some of the ones, you know, throughout the years you hear about, but
Really?
the first successful one in 1958, Oklahoma City, man, that's just rich.
Right.
And I thank you for sharing that with us. And then also we learned about Claire Lupa. You know, I never heard that name in my life.
Oh.
And if I did, I definitely forgot it. So it's just extraordinary.
Ernest, had you
Rodney, I
heard of
thank
Clara
you.
Lupa?
What's that?
Ernest, had you heard of Clara Lupa?
Who?
Had you
No.
heard of Clara Lupa, Ernest?
No. What is that? No.
I mean, the lady that started the sit-ins, Miss Lupa.
Luca?
Looper,
Luca.
Clara Looper. The lady.
Luper.
Yeah, Clara Looper. I
Luca
thought you
came
may
in
have heard
late.
of her because she, you know, she was your dad was so, your dad was like a Clara Looper in Long Beach.
Oh, okay.
Her dad was a
Yeah, he
powerful
was something,
figure.
boy.
Powerful,
He
powerful figure.
dragged us along. I didn't realize how dangerous it was, you know,
Right.
too
I
young
mean,
to
you didn't live in
remember.
Long Beach and didn't know about Ernest McBride. You just didn't.
Yeah.
I lived there for 20
Yeah.
years. I definitely knew about it.
So that's another learning experience for some of us. I think Professor Rod knew about her. I think, right, Professor Rod?
Nope.
Didn't know about it either?
No, I didn't know about this, the 1958 sit-in. No, I did not. And I taught civil rights and law. They start the civil rights movement mainly with the bus boycott in Montgomery.
Dr. King. Yeah, they talk about the Greensboro in 60 with the college students from North Carolina A&T.
Yeah, but that was in 64.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, see, there's so much that was going on during this period. There was the civil rights movement, and there was the Black Power movement. Right. I was in the Black Power movement.
Okay.
And it was just like what Miss Looper said. She believed in nonviolence. She accepted King's position.
That's Dr. King. She was a president of Dr. King.
Yeah. Well, you know, we wouldn't. We didn't. You know, we took Malcolm's position. We're going to defend ourselves. Mm-hmm. They put dogs on us. They're going to be rugs. You understand? You know, we're going to gun them. And we took a different position.
Yeah,
that's why you had the biggest rebellion in Watson County. And then when they started dumping money in, it wasn't about history. It's about get all the cash you can from the property program, jobs, opportunity. There was no Black studies until 1968.
No.
So, and most of the Black teachers was like our parents, and they didn't want us. They didn't want to tell you about the inhumane treatment they received. Most Black people who had degrees worked in the post office.
Yeah, and I'm one of them.
And yeah, you couldn't get a job.
You're one of them.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, in the post, all over the country.
I worked for the post office for 25 years.
Yeah, with a degree.
Yes.
You see, and that's a whole new different game. So, I mean, we...
With two degrees.
Yeah. Now you hear about Little Rock, Arkansas, because it was on TV.
Right.
Absolutely.
But the movement on 50, in 1958 was never on TV.
No. Not in the paper?
No. See, in those days, you didn't have mass media like you have it today. With no Facebook, with no textings and all of that. And you only had about 5 or 6 TV channels. And you break the knob, you have to turn TV with pliers or a fart.
5 or 6. I can remember when we had one.
We had 3 and PBS.
Yeah, and then at midnight, TV went off.
Well,
and midnight.
TV went off. All you got was... That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we
got a big giant cabinet and a 9-inch screen.
Yeah,
9-inch, you had that big a screen?
7-inch, 9-inch screen. Yeah, the thing in my car is bigger than what my TV was.
They had that old Hoffman Easy Vision, green looking.
And antennas on your house.
Television.
Antennas on your house, though. Ears on the TV right now.
Rabbit
ears. And you have to hit the TV to make it work right.
Yeah, I think my dad's sister was the only one in the hood there that had a TV.
And
everybody go around her house.
And all of them was black and white.
Oh, yeah.
With no color TV there.
Yeah.
You know.
It was like 48. 47
stuff.
Yeah. Well, nothing wrong with wrestling. Huh?
Yeah,
okay, we're gonna bring it to an end, fellas.
All right.
It's been a very good learning experience for us. I appreciate you, Portwood and Ronnie, for getting Portwood to come on with us. Professor Rob, is there a show for Tuesday?
I'll call you in the morning. I can't remember. You know,
the guy that they're going to recognize.
I think
from Long Beach State.
Is that the 24th? That's the 24th.
Yeah, the 24th is Tuesday.
Yeah, it's Jerry Davis. Yeah.
What's his name?
His name is Asar Davis, but his government name was Jerry Davis. He was the first, one of the most outstanding BSU presidents at Long Beach State.
Hmm.
Oh.
Okay. So that's next Tuesday.
Yeah.
And then
Blanchard, one now.
On Wednesday.
Yeah,
Jerry Davis president. Next week. Jerry Davis And then on Wednesday, we have Brother Quab and I coming back on, and the topic is NBA has no shame. He said they tripping and promoting stripping in ETC. So that'll be interesting. I didn't even know the NBA had anything to do with stripping. So I want to hear that
Are you talking about
and
Mike City?
how that's even possible.
Are
Are
you
you talking
talking
about
about
Mike City in Atlanta? I don't know, but I
Mason
want to
City in
hear it.
Atlanta? Is that what you're talking about?
I think you're
I
talking
don't
about.
know,
I
but
think
that's he's going to talk about that next week
he's talking about the
on
women
Wednesday.
and the
So I'm
cheerleaders.
looking forward to that because I don't know anything about it.
Okay, I know that there was a controversy in Atlanta because Atlanta, the Hawks are going to honor Magic City. I know the strip club where a lot of NBA players, rappers, and entertainers hang out, and one of the players said that on. And one of the players not on the Atlanta team said that wouldn't be good for the image of the NBA to be promoting a strip club.
Yeah, that's not good at all. So
Yeah, and
we're
so they
going to talk
canceled it.
about that next week.
Okay.
So I'm just going to say each one teach one in Conscious Corner. Everybody continue to have a great day.
Peace out.
Peace out.